This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, the UK Parliament voted in the last 2 hours to ratify the Prime Minister's shock announcement yesterday morning that there should be a snap general election on June the 8th. We'll be looking at the vote itself and what it means for politics in the UK. As Israeli authorities continue to show no signs of compromise over a mass hunger strike by over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, there are growing fears that the protest could reignite the sporadic Israel-Palestine conflict. But will an emboldened Israeli government be willing to heed warnings over their hunger strike clampdown and avoid triggering major unrest across the occupied territories? A report on the EU funding of NGOs by German MEP Markus Pieper has faced fierce criticism for its suggestion that the EU should reject funding for NGOs which fail to comply with the European Union's, quote, strategic, commercial and security objectives. Members of the EU's Green Group and Social Democrats have requested a withdrawal of the report, which has been called a Hungarian-style attack on NGOs. And why, oh why, have a group of Americans been kissing a car for over 48 hours? Find out at the end of the show. All that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. 24 hours on from the UK Prime Minister's statement yesterday announcing her plans to hold a snap general election on the 8th of June, and the UK Parliament voted today to ratify that decision. For more, Jack Foster has this report.
I don't think there's a need for an election. I think the next election would be in 2020. I'm not going to be calling a snap election. I've been very clear that I think we need that period of time, that stability, to be able to deal with the issues that the country is facing and have that election in 2020.
That was the UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking to the BBC's Andrew Marr show last year, not long after she took over as Prime Minister following the Brexit vote. So that was that. There would be no general election in the UK until 2020. And that was backed up by a cast iron legislation, the Fixed Parliament Act. And so no one was really expecting the announcement that she made yesterday outside of 10 Downing Street.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June. It was with reluctance that I decided the country needs this election. But it is with strong conviction that I say it is necessary to secure the strong and stable leadership the country needs to see us through Brexit and beyond.
The UK Prime Minister announcing yesterday that there would be a snap general election on the 8th of June, a decision that has well and truly thrown a proverbial spanner into the works of UK politics at a time when, well, you'd have thought it impossible to throw any more spanners in. With Brexit negotiations only just getting underway, an opposition Labour Party in disarray, divided as they are on the left-wing leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, and of course, the threat of a second referendum on Scottish independence emanating from Edinburgh. And on that last note, the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, gave a statement to members of the press in London this morning.
We intend to win this election in Scotland and for Scotland, because now more than ever, Scotland needs strong voices. Yesterday, it became clear beyond any doubt that for Theresa May, party comes before country. For months, the Prime Minister has said that a snap early general election was, in her view, the last thing that the country needed. Now was not the time, she said, to be distracted from the job at hand. But yesterday she changed her mind, not for the good of the country, but for reasons of simple party advantage. Her motive is clear. She knows that as the terms of her hard Brexit become clearer, then the deep misgivings that so many people already have will increase and grow. So she's decided to act now in an attempt to crush the parliamentary opposition that she faces.
Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon speaking to members of the press in London this morning in response to the announcement that a snap general election has been called in the United Kingdom for June the 8th. Unsurprisingly, the topic of that unexpected vote came up more than a few times at this afternoon's weekly Prime Minister's questions in the UK Parliament. Firstly, opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
We welcome the general election, but is a Prime Minister who promised there wouldn't be one. A Prime Minister who cannot be trusted. She says it's about leadership, yet is refusing to defend her record in television debates. And it's not hard to see why. The Prime Minister says we have a stronger economy. Yet she can't explain why people's wages are lower today than they were 10 years ago, or why more households are in debt, 6 million people earning less than the living wage, child poverty is up, pensioner poverty is up. So why are so many people getting poorer?
I would point out to the Right Honourable Gentleman that I have been answering his questions and debating these matters every Wednesday that Parliament has been sitting since I became Prime Minister. And I will be taking out to the country in this campaign a proud record of a Conservative government. A stronger economy, an economy with a deficit nearly two-thirds down, with 30 million people with a tax cut, 4 million people taken out of income tax altogether, record levels of employment, and £1,250 more a year for pensioners. That's a record we can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, if she's so proud of a record, why won't she debate it? Wages are falling. More children are in poverty. And the last Tory manifesto, page 28, said, we will work to eliminate child poverty. They only eliminated the child poverty targets, not child poverty. In 2010, they promised to eradicate the deficit by 2015. In 2015, they promised to eradicate the deficit by 2020. Austerity has failed.
People will have a real choice at this election. They will have a choice between a Conservative government that has shown we can build a stronger economy and a Labour Party whose economic policy would bankrupt this country. And what voters know is that under Labour, it's ordinary working people who pay the price of the Labour Party. They pay it with their taxes, they pay it with their jobs, and they pay it with their children's futures.
The UK opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn jousting with the Prime Minister Theresa May at this afternoon's PMQs. The most overtly pro-EU, anti-Brexit group in the Parliament, at UK level anyway, is that of the Liberal Democrats, and their leader Tim Farron was keen to press that point to the Prime Minister today, as well as her reluctance to take part in televised debates.
This election can change the direction of our country. From the consequences of potential hard Brexit outside the single market to the future of our NHS and social care, our schools and our environment, the British public deserve to hear the party leaders set out their plans and debate them publicly. But the Prime Minister has refused to take part in televised leaders' debates. The Prime Minister and I, back in 1992, debated publicly, forcibly and amicably when we were both candidates together. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister called out the then incumbent who did not show up for some of those debates. Why will she not debate those issues publicly now? What is she scared of?
Tim Farron, leader of the Liberal Democrats, the fourth party in the UK Parliament, in an exchange with the Prime Minister Theresa May this afternoon. But it was only once during PMQs today when the thorny issue of election fraud was raised. The UK Crown Prosecution Service is currently investigating charges against up to 20 Conservative MPs over failures to declare election spending during the last campaign, something which could potentially result in jail time for the MPs involved and their agents. And it was only the opposition Labour Party's Dennis Skinner who put that to the Prime Minister today.
Will the Prime Minister give a guarantee that no Tory MP who is under investigation by the police and the legal authorities over election expenses in the last general election be a candidate in this election, because if she won't accept that, this is the most squalid election campaign that has happened in my lifetime.
Opposition Labour Party MP Dennis Skinner in an exchange with the UK Prime Minister Theresa May during Prime Minister's questions this afternoon. And the Prime Minister faced MPs after her weekly questions session for a vote on whether or not to hold a snap election on June the 8th, something which, because of the Fixed Parliament Act, requires the approval of at least two-thirds of the Parliament in order to happen. At around 2:40pm UK time, MPs voted, and here is the result of that vote.
The ayes to the right, 522. The nose to the left, 13.
The eyes to the right, 522. The nose to the left, 13. So the eyes have it. The eyes have it.
The Speaker of the UK House of Commons, John Bercow, there confirming this afternoon's vote by MPs, which means that there will now definitely be a snap general election across the United Kingdom in just over a month from now, on Thursday the 8th of June. That will be the fourth time in 3 years that the British electorate have taken to the polls, and indeed the second general election in the same period. If voter fatigue was ever going to set in the UK, this summer would seem a logical time for that to happen. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster was on holiday yesterday when the announcement was made.
Just so preparing for voter fatigue.
We missed out on your usual expert analysis, Jack. I'm glad that you're here in the studio now to discuss it further with
listeners,
me.
Listeners, if you could see her face, you would know that she was not serious in the slightest.
Oh, that's not fair. That's not fair. Now, that was a pretty decisive vote in Parliament today, 522 to 13. How predictable was that result? And just who are the 13 MPs who voted against it?
Well, it was fairly predictable. I mean, it would be very unlikely that the Prime Minister would go to such a vote if she didn't think that she could win it. And of course, the debate beforehand as well, it was quite telling that the Chamber was not entirely full throughout. It was pretty much a foregone conclusion. I think people knew which way it was going to go. And yes, as you say, it was very decisive. 522 to 13. Who were those 13? Well, it's interesting. There's not really any kind of theme that you can kind of find from them, but there were some interesting nuggets in there. There were three Brexit supporting MPs in there. Ronnie Campbell, Labour, and a big supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. He has a very strong majority in his constituency, though, so probably doesn't have a great deal to worry about. Dennis Skinner, who we heard in the package there, he also voted against it. Well-known socialist left-winger and been an MP since, I think, since 1970. And Graham Stringer, who is also a Labour MP, he was the first MP to publicly call for Gordon Brown to resign as Prime Minister, incidentally. A little nugget of fact there for you, Carolyn. He's got a very strong majority as well. So there's no sort of sign that people with weak majorities are not keen on having an election. There were a couple, though, which you would probably suspect would be for that reason. Those specifically being Natalie McGarry and Michelle Thompson, whom, as we both know, are former Scottish National Party MPs, both suspended. Natalie McGarry was suspended over allegations of financial misconduct and fraud charges related to a previous campaign that she was involved in. And Michelle Thompson was suspended over property-related financial irregularity accusations, which actually didn't come to anything, but she is still not in the party. The thing is, they both have very, very good numbers at the last election. Michelle Thompson, not so much, but the thing is, they will inevitably be up against an SNP candidate, which will not be them, and the SNP candidate is very likely to do better than them.
Mm. Now, Theresa May has said that she is not going to take part in any of the televised debates, and that is surely not going to go down very well. So why is she doing that?
Oh, well, I mean, you could sit and wonder why she was going to do that until the cows come home. I think we can probably imagine that she doesn't want to do it because she feels that it would not tactically make any sense. I mean, if it was going to be to benefit her, then she would be straight up there, I'm quite sure. So we can assume that she doesn't think that it's tactically a good move. Her argument, of course, which is similar to previous prime ministers before her, is that she does prime minister's questions, which we heard a clip from there in that report, every week, where she faces her opponents and faces other MPs in Parliament. Of course, she doesn't face the public in prime minister's questions. And as anyone who watches prime minister's questions regularly knows, it's a little bit staged. Some of it is theatrics. A lot of the questions she does know about. A lot of the parties send out questions and things to MPs and so on beforehand as well. Not all of them, but it's staged and quite predictable, and it's certainly not something where the public engage. The other point to remember is that televised debates in the UK is a relatively new thing. We sort of have very short memories politically, well, not just in this country, in many countries. The first televised debates were in 2010, when Gordon Brown was still Prime Minister and David Cameron came in. And of course, if you remember, Nick Clegg, the Liberal Democrat leader at the time, did very, very well in them. And he did go on to become the Deputy Prime Minister, but I don't think that's quite what Liberal Democrat supporters might have wanted from those debates. It definitely did change things, and it threw a spanner in the works.
Mm-hmm. Well, just finally, who do you think stands to lose the most from this snap election?
Well, who can say? I think at the moment it looks like at UK level, the Labour Party are going to have a very difficult campaign. As we know, they are very divided. The Jeremy Corbyn's leadership is fairly openly disputed within the Parliamentary Labour Party. And it's probably not untrue to suggest that some MPs in the Labour Party will be quite pleased to be having the snap election so suddenly, and that the fact is that Jeremy Corbyn will probably have to resign, because even if he holds on to every single seat that the Labour Party have at the moment, if you don't win an election in the UK, you don't stay on, generally speaking, as the leader of the party. The other side of that coin is the Scottish National Party in Scotland. They are obviously extremely popular in Scotland, still are. They hold the vast majority of the seats in Scotland. It's very unlikely that the Conservatives or Labour or indeed the Lib Dems are going to make any great inroads in Scotland. However, the only party that stands to lose, by virtue of the fact that they hold so many seats in Scotland, is the SNP. All they need to do is lose one, two, three, maybe four seats. And it can be painted by their opponents as the high water mark of the SNP having been reached several years ago. And this is the waning of Scottish nationalism and a desire for independence going away. And of course, in this climate where the Scottish government are looking to hold another referendum on Scottish independence, that would not play very well for them.
Indeed, it will no doubt be a roller coaster a few weeks. Thank you very much, Jack
Pleasure.
Foster.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
So, continuing now with reaction to the UK Prime Minister's announcement yesterday of a snap election scheduled for June the 8th, I'm joined in the studio by Colin Fox, the national spokesperson for the Scottish Socialist Party. Hello, Colin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So, Jeremy Corbyn, Labour Party leader, levelled various charges towards the Prime Minister this afternoon. Let's look specifically at those issues of the Fixed Term Parliament Act and her refusal to take part in televised debates with her opponents. Firstly, what was the point in the Fixed Parliament Act? An act specifically designed to stop prime ministers from opportunistically holding elections at a time of their choosing, given that it's now fallen at its first hurdle?
Very good question, and it just shows that there are bigger things in life than fixed parliament acts. Theresa May has just chosen to totally disregard it,
mm-hmm.
And she's going for a opportunist grab to multiply her majority by tenfold. That's what it's all about.
Now, it's worth saying that there isn't a long tradition of televised leaders' debates in the UK. The first was only in 2010. Mm-hmm. But since then, such debates have become a major part of election campaigns in the UK. Hasn't a precedent been set? And what does that say about Theresa May that she's refusing to take part in any of the debates?
Good question. I think they're murder. I never watched them. These televised debates are absolutely criminal television. I mean, I remember one time people coming up to him in the street after one of them, "I agree with Nick." He said, "I agree with Nick." Apparently Nick Clegg had made some marvellous intervention, right? Mm. But nobody voted for him. Mm-hmm. You know, these debates, like five Humpties in suits all agreeing with each other, talking for the same narrow constituency. And the population of the country, I think, they watch it for 5 minutes, hoping it'll be different. It isn't. And they turn it over to Coronation Street. I know I do.
You think that's Theresa May's reasons for
yeah,
not
I think she
for
hopes to be in Coronation Street instead. I do have popularity for far more good.
Now, Theresa May made a lot of noise yesterday during her statement about the need to effectively establish a mandate for Brexit negotiations. So, is this snap election really just a proxy second referendum on Brexit?
No, it's not. It's a power grab for the Tories. I think Theresa May wants to increase the influence she has in the negotiations in Brussels. And let's not forget, increase the power she has in negotiations over IndyRef too. Mm. This is about 100 Tory MPs sitting behind her in a majority who'll say, there'll be no second referendum and Europe must do as we want, us little Englanders all behind them dressed up as little Englanders. Mm. That's what it's about. I mean, the country yesterday was taken by surprise because nobody anticipated it, nobody needed it, nobody wanted it. And in 2 months it'll be over and nothing will have changed except the Tories will have more seats at Westminster. Maybe the change will be that Jeremy Corbyn, who's currently a dead man walking, will have a spring in his step, freed from all the knives that are currently in his back.
How likely is it that the Prime Minister could run on a policy of rejecting a second referendum on Scottish independence? And assuming, as is pretty likely, her Conservative Party does poorly in Scotland, what sort of a mandate would she then have in terms of the Scottish question in the event of a UK-wide Tory win?
Well, remember, Theresa May has said we can't have a referendum at this time. Mm. And of course, you and I understand her accent, and that means in Scotland, not at any time. Mm. The Tories are going to try and defy the will of the Scottish people for a second referendum. And if the polls are correct and she emerges in a month's time with a 100-seat majority, then you have to say her hand is strengthened and the case for a second referendum is weakened, and we have to consider what our tactics are going to be then.
Just finally, will your party, the Scottish Socialist Party, be standing candidates in the snap election?
Well, I can tell you exclusively in Sputnik, we have an executive committee meeting tonight and we'll be deciding our strategy there. So once we've decided and once we've made up our own mind, I'll be happy to come back and give you an exclusive interview and tell you what we're going to do.
Excellent. We look forward to hearing it from you again then, Colin. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Colin Fox there, the national spokesperson for the Scottish Socialist Party. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
We are above all the latest developments and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, as Israeli authorities continue to show no sign of compromise over a mass hunger strike by over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, there are growing fears that the protest could reignite the sporadic Israel-Palestine conflict. But will an emboldened Israeli government be willing to heed warnings over their hunger strike clampdown and avoid triggering major unrest across the occupied territories? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. every day right here on Radio Sputnik. We'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
By Any Means Necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us, from mass incarceration.
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video, when I saw that, it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general. Three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik. Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, as Israeli authorities continue to show no sign of compromise over a mass hunger strike by over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, there are growing fears that the protests could reignite the sporadic Israel-Palestine conflict. But will an emboldened Israeli government be willing to heed warnings over their hunger strike clampdown and avoid triggering major unrest across the occupied territories? A report on the EU funding of NGOs by German MEP Markus Pieper has faced fierce criticism for its suggestion that the EU should reject funding for NGOs which fail to comply with the European Union's, quote, strategic, commercial and security objectives. Members of the EU's Green Group and the Social Democrats have requested a withdrawal of the report, which has been called a Hungarian-style attack on NGOs. And why, oh why, have a group of Americans been kissing a car for over 48 hours? Find out at the end of the show. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 28 minutes past the hour. As hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails continue their mass hunger strike against prison conditions, concerns are mounting that the increasingly tough response by the Israeli authorities could spark a new conflict across the region. Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Israeli police fire multiple tear gas canisters into protesters near Bethlehem. The demonstrators are marching in solidarity with 1,500 Palestinian prisoners who began a mass hunger strike in numerous Israeli jails on the 17th of April. The inmates, who regard themselves as political prisoners, are seeking improved visitation rights for family members, proper health care, and an end to routine solitary confinement. But the Israeli government and prison authorities have taken a robust position to the protest. The leaders of the hunger strikes have been removed from the main prison population and placed in solitary confinement, their clothes removed and personal belongings confiscated. Some Israeli ministers have even urged that the leader of the hunger strike, Marwan Barghouti, who is the head of the Central Fatah Committee, the highest decision-making body of the Palestinian political party, be executed for instigating the hunger strike. Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli defence minister, added that he wanted to imitate the approach of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who publicly refused to give in to demands of Irish Republican hunger strikers in 1981, who were seeking political status. 10 Irish Republican prisoners died during that protest, although the British government did eventually accede to their demands. But the danger with the Palestinian hunger strike is that it could quickly escalate, especially if prisoners begin dying, and reignite a fresh round of wider conflict in the region. Earlier I spoke to Danny Morrison, who during the 1981 hunger strikes in the north of Ireland acted as a spokesman for IRA prisoners taking part in the protest. Morrison later edited a collection of essays about his experience that was published in book form, titled simply Hunger Strike. Danny Morrison, this is a very significant mass hunger strike by the Palestinian political prisoners that they've begun. What's your assessment of the tactic they have adopted, and might they have been better to have staggered the hunger strike in the same way that Irish Republicans did in 1981?
Well, of course, that tactic was used both in 1980 and in the 1981 hunger strike, but depends on the objective of the prisoners themselves. I mean, we, during the course of our prison struggle, there were token hunger strikes where, for example, say, 7 hunger strikers in 1980, they were on their 45th day of hunger strike, and another 30 prisoners came in solidarity, but also to attract international publicity about what was going on. I'm very sad to hear this news. I have studied the plight of the Palestinian political prisoners, especially those who should be held closer to home and not moved into Israel. You know, it is a very risky strategy, and I hope that no one dies. I hope that Israel recognises the rights of these prisoners. They're fighting for exactly the same things that the British government conceded to our people at the end of the hunger strike in 1981, although at that stage, 10 of our men had died.
And can you describe the psychological and physical impact hunger strike has on those who undertake it?
Well, it requires obviously quite a determined person who is at the end of their tether, who has got complete and absolute willpower and control of the fate of their own life. I mean, it is the enemy that they are opposing, but hunger strike is actually quite liberating for some of the individuals in that the power it gives them and the control it gives them, because they are in charge of their own destiny. But it's out of a desperate situation that anyone goes on hunger strike, because of course in our case here, our hunger strikers faced, you know, what Russia termed the Iron Lady, Mrs. Thatcher, and she would not compromise at all. Even when Bobby Sands was elected and received more votes than her, and when he became an MP at Westminster, her response was to change the law through emergency legislation rather than negotiate. So my solidarity, my best wishes are with the families and the hunger strikers. And I hope that nobody does lose their life, and I hope that Israel sees sense.
You've touched on there that the hunger strike is a big risk for the Palestinians. The Israelis have perhaps predictably said they will not negotiate with the Palestinians who are seeking to improve medical care in prison and other improvements to their conditions. I mean, how optimistic are you realistically that they will be successful in this protest?
Well, that depends on how much international attention and pressure they can muster and put on Israel. Unfortunately, the times we live in, there are so many conflicts taking place that in terms of trying to concentrate minds, the world and the attention of the world is divided all over the place with what is going on in Syria, what's going on in Yemen, in Somalia, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, and now, of course, the international stage in this showdown between Trump and North Korea. So it's very difficult to assess the magnitude of pressure that can be put on Israel at this time. But, I mean, our thoughts and our solidarity are completely with the prisoners. What they're demanding is quite basic in terms of the transport that takes them to court, in terms of family rights, in terms of access to newspapers, access to their own clothes. I mean, reading their demands, it is so reminiscent of what our prisoners came through. And of course, at the end of the day, the British government, in our circumstances, was forced to concede. And I only hope that the Palestinian prisoners, and of course, 500 of them in administrative detention, which is nothing more than internment without trial, which is what, of course, we experienced here. 1,600 people here went through the equivalent of administrative detention, myself included. I was interned as a teenager without charge or trial. So we know exactly what the Palestinians are suffering, and we're in complete solidarity with them.
And finally, as you know, what happens outside the prison walls can have a big impact on the morale and success of the hunger strike inside. But if the Palestinians see the hunger strike through to its ultimate conclusion, how much of a risk does that pose in perhaps reigniting the conflict in the region?
Well, as I said, it's a very emotional issue. It does have consequences on the streets. Here, for example, whenever Bobby Sands died, basically, I mean, the area where I'm doing this interview from, West Belfast, I mean, it erupted, as did the Bogside in Derry. What it did do was, and Israel must know this, must be part of its calculus, what this will do will inspire other people to take up the Palestinian cause in militant ways. It won't inspire anybody towards a pacifistic response because of the anger that it will induce, and because basically the prisoners' demands are just. They fall under universal rights of prisoners, and it is the Israeli government which is breaking those rules.
Danny Morrison, many thanks for speaking to us today on World in Focus. Danny Morrison there. Well, I'm now joined by Dr. Amir Pazfush, a senior lecturer in law at the University of Sussex and an expert on the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Dr. Pazfush, does Israel not run a risk here that if they are seen to make conditions even worse for the prisoners who are taking part in this hunger strike, that they will encourage even greater international condemnation? Is Israel's response the right one?
Obviously, depends what position you take in general with regards to human rights and the ability for them to be subordinate to national security, or if you just take a very cynical, kind of real political perspective on this issue. In either case, for my personal, I would think that Israel is mistaken and misguided in both respects. I think that it subordinates human rights concerns to national security on this issue in a way that perhaps only one other democratic country does, which is the U.S.
And the Israeli Intelligence and Transportation Minister has said that Marwan Barghouti, the head of the Central Fatah Committee who is leading the hunger strike, should be executed for leading such protests. With no sign of any compromise, we could potentially see hundreds of Palestinian prisoners starving themselves to death. Will Israel be worried about such a scenario and what that might mean to their international reputation and standing? Is that part of their calculation, do you think?
I think at the moment, I did mention America, and I think and America and Israel see eye to eye on the particular issue of force feeding. European Court of Human Rights, Britain, Germany, France, all have pretty much held the position that force feeding is allowed only when the health of a prisoner is compromised. America, up until now, was the only outlier. Now Israel, unsurprisingly, joins it in taking into account issues that do not concern the prisoner's health, which is national security, country's reputation, social unrest, various other issues such as that. This is relatively new for Israel. There was a law that was passed in 2015 that pretty much aligned Israel's position to that of America following court decision in a Guantanamo Bay case. That legislation, by the way, was challenged by the Doctors Association, interestingly, doctors did not want to be part. So the formal, kind of very mainstream Doctors Association in Israel, the Israel Medical Association, challenged that law and failed before the Supreme Court.
And force feeding isn't a straightforward process. Does the Israeli prison authorities have the resources to do this? I mean, they would be having to undertake force feeding on an unprecedented scale.
That is true. It is unprecedented. And with regards to another comment that you made earlier in your question, I don't see the situation where you will see Palestinian prisoners dying. I think that Israel would opt for force feeding so as not to allow prisoners to die. By the way, Britain has had interesting experience in that respect, both with regard to the suffragists about 100 years ago, and of course with regards to Irish Republicans in more recent history in the 1980s. And in the latter case, prisoners were, quote unquote, allowed to die, and the prison authorities did not intervene. I think that in this case, prison authorities will intervene.
And does this intervention, you know, that you've suggested that the Israeli authorities would not want to see prisoners die, does their desire to intervene reflect their understanding that if prisoners start dying on a large scale, that may spark a fresh wave of conflict breaking out across the occupied territories?
Very much so. Prisoners are are one of the less discussed, I think, issues when people can look into, you know, the quote-unquote peace process or negotiations, etc. Prisoners are, as you mentioned, Marwan Barghouti, it's almost a rite of passage within the Palestinian population. Oh, if only by virtue of the numbers are staggering. I think since 1977, 600,000 people within the Palestinian population were incarcerated in Israeli prisons. That is about 20% of the population. So we're talking about the fact that almost every family has a member of the family. There is a member of the family, or at least they know at the very least, probably there is a member of the family that was in an Israeli prison. So it's a major, it's obviously not a criminal issue. These are, the vast majority of them are political prisoners, even if they took part in violent measures such as stone throwing on roads, etc., etc. But the vast majority of them are politically motivated. So this is a major, major issue, and the Palestinian population look at the situation of prisoners as a telltale sign. So to lead the movement, and the Palestinian population will take their cues from the prisoners. And if one, even one, let alone if there are, you know, a dozen or so prisoners who start dying, that would spark a massive, massive unrest. And the Israeli authorities are well aware of that, and hence the new law, which followed, by the way, a previous prison strike in 2012. So the Israeli authorities, even though they already have, interestingly enough, they already have some statutory, they had some statutory backing for intervening and force feeding under health laws, right? So force feeding, say, people who suffer, an individual who suffers from anorexia, that is already in Israeli legislation. But the fact that they changed the law in 2015 to address the issue specifically of prisoners says something about Israeli concerns that prisoners shouldn't, obviously we're talking about Palestinian political prisoners, should not be allowed to die.
Dr. Amir Pasfouks, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus today.
You're very welcome.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, a report on the EU funding of NGOs by German MEP Marcus Piper has faced fierce criticism for its suggestion that the EU should reject funding for NGOs which fail to comply with the European Union's, quote, strategic, commercial and security objectives. Members of the EU's Green Group and Social Democrats have requested a withdrawal of the report, which has been called a Hungarian-style attack on NGOs. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together. You ready? Are you ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Into Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about about the stories behind the stories.
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman programme.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, a report on the EU funding of NGOs by German MEP Marcus Piper has faced fierce criticism for its suggestion that the EU should reject funding for NGOs which failed to comply with the European Union's, quote, strategic, commercial and security objectives. Members of the EU's Green Group and Social Democrats have requested a withdrawal of the report, which has been called a Hungarian-style attack on NGOs. And why, oh why, have a group of Americans been kissing a car for over 48 hours? We'll have an answer for you at the end of the show. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 46 minutes past the hour. An own initiative report by Marcus Piper, a German member of the European Parliament, for the European People's Party, or EPP-affiliated Christian Democratic Union, has come under fire for its suggestions that EU-funded NGOs should face stricter rules and further scrutiny. The report has been referred to as a Hungary-style report in reference to the crackdown on foreign-funded NGOs by Hungarian leader Viktor Orban. Members of the Green Group within the European Parliament and the Social Democrats have stated that the report is misleading and inaccurate and could have a negative impact on how NGOs are viewed and treated. The aspect that has sparked the most controversy is the German MEP's suggestion that the European Commission should reject funding for NGOs which oppose, quote, the strategic and security objectives, end quote, of the European Union. Fellow EPP member, the Czech MEP, Tomáš Zadovský, said that the report is a necessary move to ensure EU money is spent well, stating that funding shouldn't be given to groups which campaign against EU policy, such as the anti-TTIP, that being the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, NGOs. Earlier today, I spoke with Françoise Ballat, an executive advisor with the European Youth Forum, and asked if, given the comparisons made to Hungary's crackdown on NGOs, which faced fierce criticism within the EU, did this report legitimise the Hungarian government's actions?
Well, I don't think it gives any legitimacy to a crackdown on NGOs from either in Hungary or in Europe. It's just sending a worrying message that some MEPs would think that we need to have stricter rules apply to NGOs that would not align with their policy positions.
Now, some of the proposals are about making more controls over the funding of NGOs who, as the Czech MEP pointed out, some NGOs receive EU funding for activities that oppose EU policies, such as funding NGOs that lobby against TTIP. Is this just suggesting that more transparency is needed here on where EU money is going?
I think in general there is already a high level of transparency when it comes to EU funding, and NGOs apply to these rules, especially the one directly lobbying EU institutions. I think, again, it's sending a wrong message if you would cut EU funding for associations that would go against EU policies. The report mentions the strategic interest of the EU, and we believe it's in the interest of the EU to have a voice in the civil society that would criticize, argue, and have a dialogue with them to develop policies. So there is transparency, and it should apply to everyone, not only to NGOs, but to every organization, association, or individuals that are involved in policy making.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned there, it's the strategic interest that's caused some controversy that's been highlighted in this report. Is that because then you're asking some MEPs to make a subjective decision over which NGOs might be acting politically against the EU? Is that the root of the problem with that proposal?
Yeah, why targeting NGOs that would go against some of the policies, and the question more important is to see who defines the strategic interest of the EU. We are in a democratic system where every voice should be heard, and it's also in the interest of the EU to have this dialogue. It's also part of the treaty of the EU to have this dialogue with civil society. So where is the interest of the EU in the end?
Mm-hmm. Well, Francois, thank you so much for speaking to us today. It's lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
That was Francois Ballat, the executive advisor for the European Youth Forum, speaking to me earlier today. And earlier on today, I also spoke with Valentina Caimi, the policy and advocacy advisor with Social Platform, a civil society alliance of 47 pan-European NGOs. And I began by asking her what her initial reaction to this report was.
Well, the initial reaction was we sent to the parliamentarians some proposals for amendments because the report contains information that is not correct and is also misleading. In particular, because the report focuses on lack of transparency in how NGOs are funded from the EU budget. But it's not only NGOs that receive funding from the EU budget, it's also other types of beneficiaries. And the rules are the same for all types of beneficiaries. So saying that there is a transparency in funding NGOs means that there is maybe lack of transparency in how the Commission usually finances all the types of beneficiaries, while the report is only about NGOs, and this is misleading.
Mm-hmm. And the report has already faced a great deal of criticism, but what impact will the rhetoric of this report have on how we view NGOs?
Well, it's going to, of course, if the report is adopted as it is, it's going to put in jeopardy the accountability of NGOs, their work, because there are, for example, statements such as NGOs spread around information that is not correct, or that we receive a lot of funding compared to other types of beneficiaries, which is not true. So it's going to make basically the... It also proposes to set additional requirements for funding and transparency only for NGOs and not for all types of beneficiaries from the EU budget. So in this way, it's going to put NGOs in a more difficult position. In a context where funding for NGOs is decreasing and NGOs face more and more difficulties in carrying out their work. I'm referring to especially not really the European context, but more what is happening in some member states, such as Hungary, for example.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that leads to a kind of further cynicism and scepticism of NGOs in the wider community?
Yeah, and this is also going to maybe increase, because the report is really based on information that is not correct, but of course people are not necessarily going to check the source of the information, etc. And this is going to basically put in a bad light NGOs in general.
Mm-hmm. And this report itself is right now just an own initiative report. It's not as if it's going to come into effect or into legislation immediately or anything. If legislation was to be brought forward in the future, though, akin to the suggestions of this report, just how big an impact could it have on NGOs across Europe and that operate globally as well?
Well, what is also very curious is that currently in the European Parliament, there is, and also in the Council, there are negotiations about a revision of the financial rules that were proposed by the Commission in September. While the report seems to completely overlook this process, that this process is going on. It's true that it is an on-initiative report, so it's not going to lead to legislation necessarily. But anyway, it can contribute to, maybe can put more pressure on the Commission. It can also, for example, in 2018, there is going to be the revision of different EU funding programs. And these programs are going to, some of them foresee operational grants, and some of them go to NGOs. And as usually these processes have to be adopted, not only, so the Commission proposes, but then it's also the Parliament and the Member States that need to basically give their approval. And if misleading information is given around, it can influence these processes in the future. So it's going to have possibly a negative impact on funding for NGOs in the coming years.
Well, Valentina, thank you very much for joining us today. It's lovely to have you on World in Focus.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Radio Sputnik.
And finally for today, how far would you go to win a car? Well, a group of Americans entered a competition on Monday morning of this week. Yes, that's 48 hours ago, US time. And all they had to do was kiss a car. A group of around 20 took on the challenge, which insisted on contestants keeping their lips on the car for as long as possible, with just a 10-minute break each hour. By Tuesday afternoon, only 11 remained. Apparently, if after 50 hours there is no outright winner, a name will be drawn at random to pick the lucky winner. And that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to all previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, and the team here at World in Focus, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Radio Sputnik.
If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Learn more about modern Bitcoin Ponzi schemes, the evolution of Nigerian money emails, and the false promises behind the happy, skinny, sexy pills. See how Big Pharma is bribing your doctor with cash and even fishing trips so he could possibly prescribe you with more drugs. Discover what timeshares are and lottery fraud and how not to get swindled out of your hard-earned money. Listen to our new series, Caveat Emptor, Scammers Gonna Scam. This week on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.